We have been through 6 chapters of Daniel, and we are going to take another step today in Daniel as we move forward in the book. If we talk briefly about my background, what we've then covered to date, Daniel 1, if you remember right, I'm back. That involves Daniel, if you recall, and his 4 friends being taken from Jerusalem. And that Jerusalem had been overthrown, had been conquered, taken to Babylon, and they were then educated into the Babylonian system there. You may remember the first of multiple trials there these teenagers experienced. The first one is seemingly a simple one. It was just about diet. And in a case like this, Daniel actually persuaded the overseer of those caring for the diet, their diet, and certainly proposed a little experiment where he would eat other things and then show himself and the result of him eating that diet. And you know that it translated eventually into after him being healthier and the diet's changing for everyone, those who happen to be in school, all those students, that the diet was actually changed for everyone there. And if you recall, even at the tail end of chapter 1, then talks about Daniel's wisdom through that. And even as he was able to share that information and God's use of him, that notion of excellent spirit comes through multiple times in the early part of this book. God uses Daniel then to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, if you remember by background. The first dream we see in the book, those friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, go with Daniel before God to seek God's help to make sense of this. You likely remember Nebuchadnezzar happened to have had this dream, and then he, even as he called wise men to come in and interpret the dream, they said, well, tell us the dream, and we'll tell you the interpretation. And what was his response? No, you tell me the dream and the interpretation. So Daniel was then inspired to do both. Even as those wise men happened to have been killed and word got to Daniel, Daniel and his friends then pray to God, they beseech God. Daniel is able to not only tell the dream of that great image, which we'll reference multiple times in this message, but then he's able to talk about its different parts. What did that great image entail? From that, then he's promoted. He receives a promotion, which takes us to Daniel 3 by background. Well, seemingly Daniel's away, and we're not necessarily sure why he's not in the story. We'll use the Babylonian names of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah here. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, for whatever reason that we oftentimes remember more often, are commanded to bow before an image that is then built by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, we separate ourselves a couple of decades from the dream that he'd had and the interpretation that Daniel was able to share. But what we know is whatever this image was, all of those who happened to be within earshot of the image at the sound of the lyre, the trumpet, all the musical instruments, everyone goes down. We don't catch Daniel in the story. We do catch the fact that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, no way. We're not going down. And if you remember the clause or the catch here, the disobedience involved them being thrown into a fiery furnace. And what do they say to that? Fine, but we're not going down. And we're going to honor our God, even if it means that we burn to death. Indeed, you know this, they don't burn to death. In fact, they are able to not only enter and exit a fiery furnace with no smoke on their clothes, they do so with a 4th individual, at least that's what was looked at as Nebuchadnezzar looked in and said, don't I see a 4th person in that fire? And is not that someone who looks like the Son of Man? And so what we are reminded there is again from this, that they, in obeying God, are not only protected but promoted once more. Daniel 4. Daniel is then asked to interpret a 2nd dream of Nebuchadnezzar. And this one involves a tree, if you remember by background, a tree that winds up being chopped down. Even as Daniel is able to go in and make sense of this dream based upon God's inspiration, If you recall what takes place here, Nebuchadnezzar is then warned. That chopping down was a reference to him not acknowledging the fact that God had placed him in that leadership role. And Daniel tells him about this. He says, don't disregard God's role in allowing you to be king, to ruling this empire. Nebuchadnezzar conveniently forgets. 12 months after he's been told, and just as sure as the words come out of his mouth about what a great guy I am, somewhat reminiscent of that first message we heard today, he's then turned into a beast, something that in all likelihood kind of wandered the North 40. And they don't see him for 7 years, which is telling there in terms of the consequence of his behavior. After 7 years, God restores his ability, his clarity of who he is, and he is restored back to the king as being king of Babylon. And from that point, if you remember, then he says, I need to write this down, which he does. He goes and writes a proclamation about the greatness of the true God. The only chapter that appears in God's word that is authored by an unconverted king comes from Nebuchadnezzar in this event. Daniel 5. We're up to Belshazzar. This, in all likelihood, would have been Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. He's now king. Instead of learning from his grandfather, with his enemy, the Medes and the Persians, camped right outside the gates of Babylon, he decides not to worry, but instead to throw a massive party and invite 1,000 guests. As the party kind of goes on, it devolves to a point where in his superiority, he decides to show disdain for the one true God. And remember what winds up taking place here. He says, remember all of those holy vessels from the temple in Jerusalem, bring those in and let's drink from those. To which God says, enough is enough. A hand appears in the room and writes on the wall for all to see. And no surprise, the fear of Belshazzar had to be present. He doesn't know what to do, starts asking questions. And this individual, Daniel, who's now taken a lower role within the kingdom, is called once more to come in. Daniel reads. Daniel says, in short, my paraphrase, you're done. God's done. Within 24 hours, you will be dead. And your empire will be taken over by those who happen to be outside your gates. And that's exactly what happens. Daniel 6, most recently, we covered. Our most recent chapter then tells of a new government. In this case, Darius, King Darius, who happens to be in there of the Medes and Persians, left a lot of the infrastructure in place. In fact, he set up 120 governors, of which three were above the others, and Daniel was one of those. And these governors all watched Daniel, maybe knowing some of his history, begin to say, how do we get this guy? There's got to be something in his character that we can exploit. And after talking among themselves, they eventually come to the realization of, wait a sec, the only way we can get this guy is if we go after his God. So they covertly, sneakily, wind up having King Darius write a proclamation whereby Daniel can't honor his God. Any kind of worship can only go to Darius. How does Daniel respond to that? I'm going to my God. He immediately goes to prayer, doesn't he? And he's discovered. And even when being brought in, Darius is mortified by this. He's sickened by the fact that his good friend Daniel has been revealed in this way. And so Daniel is thrown into the lion's den. But what winds up happening, as we well know from the story, even as an old man, nothing happens. Even as Darius comes and asks, Daniel, are you there? And he, if you remember right, live long, king. I'm fine. And rather than Daniel then be the feast, who does he wind up going after in this case? the accusers, and not just the accusers, their families. And they are thrown in the lion's den, and they wind up being that feast for the lions. God then delivers Daniel, now older, once more, which then takes us up to Daniel 7. We're going to cover Daniel 7 today. I'm going to do the best I can to move rapidly through the book. This will be not some exhaustive, lengthy, hopeful discourse, because many of us are familiar with what's in Daniel, but we're going to make our way through it today in the remainder of this message. I've entitled this message, Daniel 7, I'm getting catchy there, Sense Making of Beasts and Supreme Beings. Sense Making of Beasts and Supreme Beings, or if it's easier for you, Making Sense of Beasts and Supreme Beings. I'll offer just a brief sense of sources here. I went to my Ambassador College notes. I went to one of the booklets outside, The Final Superpower, which really works well if you're reading, getting familiar with Daniel. I went to the UCG commentary. Went to a number of sermons on the topic. One that I appreciated was Mr. John Garnett that was given about 4 years ago on the subject. So I'll be drawing from those as sources. If we talk about, again, background to Daniel, we've already covered what's here. I'll only note that it's interesting in the layout of Daniel that the first six chapters are generally chronological and autobiographical. And so he's talking in timeline about certain events that took place. When you transition from 6 to 7, the remainder of the book is principally prophetic. It's topical, if you happen to be in my classes. We'll talk about transitioning from chronology to topical. And then we read these in-depth prophecies as they go forward. If we were to take what's offered in Daniel 7 by timeline, if that helps, it would actually be inserted right before Daniel 5. So it would appear between 4 and 5. But that's not how God lays it out, and we take that assuming God knows best. It's valuable also to note that what appears here aligns with what we've already covered in Daniel 2. Now, I note this, happen to have handed out something to you. These are the images that appear in that Final Superpower booklet. The biggest thing that I'm going to offer for you is I handed you a couple, 2-3 months, a table. The table I asked, if you would, to tuck away in your Bible. I went to our website to see if the table was there with the updating of the website. I had difficulty finding it. So if you happen to be one that wants to look at the table, here we go. I'm going to give you a shortcut to get there. If you go on atlanta.ucg.org and let's run the URL on your browser and you type in Daniel 2, you can go find this sermon. I'm going to bring it up for you. You can find the sermon, and if you scroll on that little scroll bar, 51 minutes in, 51:40 exactly, the handout is there on the screen for you. Okay, that's that handout, but I'll make reference to the handout multiple times. If you already have it in your Bible, then it's easy to go there. Couple more reminders just briefly before we get into this. Prophecy, even as we've been covering in Revelation 17, it's helpful to understand what prophecy is. And I've been reminded of this multiple times with Mr. Gerald Oss going through these Revelation Bible studies. For whatever reason, as a younger guy, prophecy oftentimes felt like something foreign, not relevant. And we've been reminded multiple times through these Bible studies that prophecy is, yes, history written in advance, which we oftentimes use, but it is essentially a cause and effect. That when we don't follow God, there is a result. We see this in Deuteronomy 28. We see it in Leviticus 26, oftentimes mentioned in these Bible studies. Galatians 6:7, whatever you sow, you reap. That's what prophecy is. And if we kind of get a sense for, in general, how human beings work and think and act over a timeline, sometimes in class we'll talk about life arcs, ARC, the idea that for a period of time as a younger person, we will get older, 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 and then there's kind of a tipping point where, I hate to tell you, things start to get slower and start to age, and you get the idea. That's just our reality. Now, whether you know this or not, that little example is roughly the same as how countries and empires work, because they work the same way in general. The beauty of knowing God's truth is what? Is that even while we have the ability to move forward, that regression doesn't happen with character and eventually being called into God's kingdom. So there is no regression in terms of that with our character. That's a beauty of what's offered there. But that notion of cause and effect is important. The last thing I'll note, and I'm going to just make reference to two verses that finished. In fact, I'll turn there just briefly. Beyond what Mr. Scott Thomas spoke on, 2 Peter 1, verse 20. He read through 19, if I'm not correct. 2 Peter 1, if I said 2. 2 Peter 1, verse 20. That's where I'm going. I think I said that once, but let's go again. And it's simply this. It's the idea that someone just can't come up with prophecy. There's an underscore here, some emphasis that Peter is inspired to write, a recognition that God inspires. And we need to see this. Verse 20 reads this way, knowing this first, that no prophecy of Scripture is of any private interpretation. It's not making things up, but it actually comes from somewhere. For prophecy never came by the will of man, but by holy men of God, like we read in Daniel and we read in Revelation. Holy men of God spoke as they were moved by God's Spirit, by the Holy Spirit. It's a good reminder here about what we're reading. And what we oftentimes then find, whether it be on the table that I just referenced to you, is oftentimes prophecies are reinforced by locations elsewhere in Scripture. So that said, that notion of cause-effect, let's wander into chapter 7. It's probably easiest to get a sense for what's here, to break it down just briefly into two major parts. And if you're in Daniel 7 with me now, there's a natural break. Verses 1 through 14, if you read Daniel 7, is about this dream that he has. Verses 15 through the remainder of the book is the interpretation of that dream. So let's just deal with it that way. We'll read about the dream first in Daniel 7, and then we'll read about the interpretation of the dream immediately after it. Now, let's deal with some parts even as we go through the early part of the dream when it's not necessarily dealt with at length in the back end, because there are elements here you'll see. But certainly informed by Daniel 2, there's some stuff that we can take from this. So if you will, read with me Daniel 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. And for whatever reason, if you have a night pad, say, beside your nightstand by your bed, you may do the same thing. I don't know this. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, and we get details of that lion as you move through this. Verse 5, and suddenly another beast, a second like a bear. And we move to the third beast, verse 6, after this, a leopard, which happens to have, strangely enough, four heads. Verse 7, after I saw this, this fourth beast comes up, and this is a dreadful beast. And this is going to take attention here early on in the front end of this chapter, but it's going to get a lot of attention on the back end in the interpretation portion. And there are horns involved in verse 8, which is what we'll get to as we backtrack. Verse 9, and I watched till the thrones were put in. So there's a scene change that has to happen here between verses 8 and 9. Sometimes you're watching a television show or a movie, you'll watch one scene and they'll cut away to another scene. This is another scene we then see. Verse 9, I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancients of Day, and the Ancients of Days was seated. So this is the chief character of this section of the scene. And you can read through here some of the details. Verse 11, and I watched because the sound of the pompous words, which the horn, this one horn, this little horn, gets all this attention in this book. Verse 12, for the rest of the beasts, they had dominion taken away. And we get another scene in 13. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. So the Son of Man becomes the focus of this latter part of the dream. And then the dream ends in 14. Now, we did a kind of a flyover there. to get a sense of what's there. Let's now backtrack and let's read in detail. We did a little preview about what we're to cover. Let's work our way through this in greater detail. Verse 1, here we go. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had this dream. And he wakes up and he writes down these facts, whatever they might be. Verse 2, Daniel spoke, saying, "And I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." So we have to stop maybe long enough to ask ourselves, what is he saying? What we're about to see, what we recognize him saying, even as we move forward, is Daniel in this dream and these visions is actually going to see a timeline of history, about 2,500 years, which is pretty remarkable as God inspires him here. He's going to be able to see this timeline, and he's not maybe going to necessarily, even as we come to the end of the chapter, get a sense for what this is. What is this stuff? But you and I have kind of had a hint about what this is because we've already been through Daniel 2. Because what he's going to see is going to parallel what he spoke of that great image just a few chapters later, earlier in his life. And so what we move through here is this, sometimes we'll talk about analogs. If you happen to be in my class, we'll talk about analog thinking. In other words, it's this. Sometimes you and I will do things. We use analog thinking all the time. We don't necessarily know we do this. But if we come into a situation where it's difficult to make a decision, we'll ask ourselves, when have I done something similar to this? What steps did I take? How can I go back and rely on those steps in this instance? That's analogic thinking. We use it all the time. Believe it or not, what you have here is really a parallel account. It's analogic thinking. It's, as you'll see, Daniel relying on, in part, elements of that image. Well, they'll match up nicely. And although he won't necessarily see that, but you and I will. Daniel spoke, saying, "In my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." A couple of things we need to pay attention. The term four is going to come up repeatedly here. If you go look at a range of different commentaries, they'll talk about four oftentimes being associated with rise and fall of nations or authority. It's just helpful at least to keep in mind. As we work our way forward, these notion of four winds is really the idea that winds are coming from four directions, south, north, east, and west. There's a stirring, as he's saying in this dream, that takes place. And he's trying to make sense of this stirring. And the stirring involves these winds. It also involves this great sea. Now, we can see from elsewhere in Scripture the notion that a sea oftentimes references people. In fact, you can go to a number of different places. Revelation 13, Revelation 17, I won't go there only for sake of time, that seas we oftentimes associate with peoples or large groups of humanity. And so what we begin to see here, even with this stirring as he sees this vision in his dream, is he's going to start seeing these images pop up before him, and he's going to try and make sense of what's there. And the four great beasts, these beasts then come on the scene for his dream. Came up from the sea, those peoples that we spoke of, each different from another. So let's deal with details about this first one. The first one was like a lion and had eagle's wings. And I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So even as we make sense of what's here, one of the things, as I've already said, that we have benefit of is making sense of, by timeline, what occurs earlier and later in terms of world empires. Whether you know it or not, and you probably, if I were to ask you, what symbol routinely does the U.S. associate with itself? Well, you'd probably come to, a flag of stars and stripes. If I were to ask you an animal, the whole room, if you're half American, would figure out quickly there's an eagle associated with us. So whether you know this or not, routinely, Babylon was associated with eagles. No, stop this. Lions, that's better. Let's get to the right place. Was always associated with lions. Now, this lion has eagle's wings, which is kind of a twist on that. But this notion of lions, if we back up here, if you remember back in Daniel 2, if you recall, I was able to show here the Ishtar Gate, which is actually one of the gates from Babylon. Remember the imagery that was on there? One prominent image, and oftentimes was an image throughout the kingdom, was the lion. And it was an image that they held to, that they embraced, because it showed strength and dominance. They understood that. If you go and see that Ishtar Gate, and you can see images on your phone, it actually shows those lions. I noted the Pergamon Museum in Berlin actually has it now, and you can see that. But needless to say, that lion we associate with Babylon, as do we, remember we're linking there, that's what that table did for us, with that head of gold. We go back to Daniel 2. So what about these eagle's wings? What in the world goes on with this? Well, again, there's a range of sources that all refer to the following. They talk about how Babylon, as an empire, oftentimes had a speed, an ability to reach far distances. The empire was known for that. Thereby, those eagle's wings would make sense, metaphorically in terms of distance and reach. How about the back end of the verse? And a man's heart was given to it. Oh, that, let me back up. Man, and a man to stand on whose two feet like a man. And a man's heart was given to it. Now let's stop long enough to think about who was, and we've just been through this, who was leading Babylon for the most part? Nebuchadnezzar was. What happened to the guy? Well, we just went through this. He was actually made an animal for a long period of time, 7 years. That's seven really bad years in my book. 7 years. And then what winds up happening? His sense of clarity about who he is restored. He's in essence given a man's heart once more, which then would fit partially with the explanation here. So that then takes care of this first piece. Again, linking the lion with Babylon and the head of gold just makes sense. They match up. Let's go to verse 5, and suddenly another beast. So the first beast was this lion with wings. Another beast rises up. And that second beast, we happen to know, is a bear. It was raised up on one side. In other words, for whatever reason, it looked imbalanced. One part was higher than the other and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. So it's walking around looking like it was feasting. And they said, thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. If you go back, and we have a sense again of Daniel 2 in terms of timeline and chronology, the bear, in this case, was looked at as an alliance of two powers at that time. And many historians will say the same, if not Bible scholars will say the same things. If we look at then this bear would be reflective of that Medo-Persian Empire. If you go back historically, again, because God's just giving us images to make sense of history, Persia was definitely the more dominant power out of the Medes and Persians. There's no doubt there. So this notion of imbalance makes sense when we understand the imagery that's here. If you drop down here and you get a sense of these three ribs, what does this entail? Well, the Medes and the Persians, remember, they were camped outside with Belshazzar, the gate, and they wound up taking over. They wound up taking over three smaller empires, which is what the history books tell us. They took over Babylon, we know that for sure. They took over the section of Lydia, and they took over Egypt. History tells us this. And so what we wind up with is indeed this bear raised up on one side, which we've explained, then in this case actually takes these kingdoms, these smaller kingdoms. And it's recognized as this. Verse 6, let's keep going. And after this, I looked, and there was another like a leopard. So we've been through, in this case, lions and bears and a leopard. And this leopard on its back had wings of a bird. We had wings before, so wings must have something to do with this. And the beast also had, now this was an odd one, as we don't see beasts like this too often. This one had four heads, which seems very odd to say. It had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Now, again, Daniel 2 is a help, and I shouldn't be short-sighted to say Revelation 13, which we've been through recently, and Revelation 17 also helps to offer a lot here, to flesh out the account. But what we know here is that, again, where Babylon was conquered by the Medes and the Persians, the Greco-Macedonian Empire then conquered the Medes and the Persians. And what we then find as it links with that belly and thighs of bronze in Daniel 2 is that Greco-Macedonian Empire was a powerful empire. Now, what about these four heads? Well, let's start with the wings. What are the wings about? Well, we know that those wings routinely show, or they illustrate well, speed at which an empire conquers its enemies. And the Greco-Macedonian Empire, Alexander the Great was tremendously forceful and rapid at conquering nations. The amazing part about this is he didn't live long. And when he died, his generals then took over that territory. So if you have a sense to go back and look at your history, Antipater, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy were all those generals. Alexander the Great did conquer very rapidly, all within about a decade, and then his generals all step in and take that land, that empire that he had conquered. And so what we find again is, as seemingly, you know, foreign as this image may be with four heads, it makes complete sense for a period of time. That Greco-Macedonian Empire was formidable. Verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast. Now, this one, again, as I already shared, is really troubling to him, whatever this might be. A fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before, and it had 10 horns. And I was considering these horns. And there was another horn, a little horn, one coming up from among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. So there happened to be three horns that this little horn plucks up. And there in this horn, this little horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. My margin actually notes here, we're speaking great things. So let's pause just momentarily. We have already kind of a timeline. If we're dealing with a great image, we already know from Daniel 2 and from elsewhere, we happen to know by background that the Babylonians would have come first with gold. We happen to know the Medo-Persians happen to be silver in terms of chest and arms. If we go down, Greco-Macedonians, belly and thighs of bronze. What then comes after that? Well, Daniel 2 tells us that would have been the Roman Empire as it comes in here. And even as we have a sense of what's here, it's helpful at least to pay some attention, and we'll pay a little more attention later on this, that these horns, they look to be in some ways contemporary. In other ways, they tend to happen by sequence. Now, if we go back to that great image, remember that those 10 toes were all contemporary as they made their way down. So sometimes horns are, I'll use the term we use in school, synchronous. They happen at the same time. Sometimes they're asynchronous. In other words, they happen one after another or successively. And so there are elements here that we have to give attention. If we're in verse 8, as I've already noted here, these horns are valuable. Now, this little horn, which is kind of intriguing, I will take a minute to kind of focus on here. This horn, for whatever reason, has a mind of its own. Were eyes like the eyes of a man, tail end of 8, and a mouth speaking pompous words, speaking these great things. For whatever reason, this horn really thinks a lot of itself. And this horn seems to take on a lot of power. And we're going to see this horn explained in much greater detail during the second half of the chapter, so we'll get back there. But it is helpful at least to recognize that even as the Roman Empire rises at the end and this horn seems to be a part of it, there's some connection here. Obviously, we oftentimes associate the Roman Empire with a military power. This little horn that's speaking these pompous words seems to be a spiritual component of this empire. So let's jump into 9. I watched till all thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. Now, what's intriguing here is we get a description of this Ancient of Days. His garment was as white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, and its wheels a burning fire. Now, we get another description like this over in Revelation 1. We'll go away once or twice here. Hang with me. Leave a marker where you're at. Revelation 1, verse 14. You're going to get a brief description of who this Ancient of Days is. And we're going to contrast that, which we know comes later, the Son of Man. If you're with me in Revelation 1, verse 14, it reads this way, even as we drop down and we're seeing some of what takes place here. One like the Son of Man clothed in a garment down to his feet is listed here. His head and his hair were white like wool and white as snow, and his eyes are like a flame of fire. So we get a very similar description when you're in Revelation 1 verse 14. But we know that this is not the Son of Man, because we know the Son of Man is going to come to this Ancient of Days, which only leaves us with one conclusion. This Ancient of Days has to be God the Father. There's no other option in terms of making a decision what's here. And we see Ancient of Days then used multiple times. And so as we make our way through this, we see a description, verse 10. Now, the verse 10 is kind of a corollary to even what we see in terms of a description of God's throne in Ezekiel and Revelation 4. Many of these elements are going to be here. I'll back up a hair. His throne was a fiery flame. Its wheels a burning fire. Those are going to fit with Ezekiel. And Revelation. A fiery stream issued that oftentimes deals with either great brightness or literal fire. But again, he's picking this up in a dream, came forth from him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him, whoever this Ancient of Days is, which we now have figured out it's God the Father. 10,000 times 10,000. If I've done my math right, that's 100 million. Stood before him. The court was seated. The judgment was seated. God was seated. And the books were open. Now, we've seen some of this before, even in a description of God's throne. We've also seen reference to those books, if you recall by background. We see all the way back in Revelation 22, those books referenced. And if you recall, they not only speak to the word of God, these are books, but the book of life. Also, so it's helpful at least to understand that. We're leading toward a judgment that then's taking place. Verse 11, so then we get a scene. We've had one scene earlier, a second scene. And then we have this insert. And I watch then because of the sound of the pompous words. This little horn is going to it. Which the horn was speaking. And I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had dominion taken away. Yet their lives were prolonged for a season. There was a duration they were allowed to act. Okay, we left a marker here. I'm back to Revelation 13. Let's make a run over there, and then we'll be back. Revelation 13, verses 5 through 6. Remember, we talked about parallel accounts. And we've already noted Daniel 2. We've noted Daniel 7. We can insert Daniel 8 if we get there before the spring holidays. Fine. If not, fine. Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 all then come into play because they're talking about similar accounts. Revelation 13, verse 5, read with me if you will. And he was given a mouth. Who was given a mouth? Well, whoever this dragon. So they worship the dragon in verse 4. He was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. We, in church speak, talk about it as 3.5 years. This is not a stretch. We're familiar with this. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority was given to him over every tribe and tongue and nation. And so what we find here is this beast speaks blasphemies, even as we've talked briefly about this in times past in many of messages, and boy, we have plenty of publications out on the table. You can go read about this. it becomes pretty obvious that it is a spiritual power associated with that Roman Empire. It's not a stretch for us to point to say the papacy is involved here in terms of these blasphemous words. And so we find that here. And as we see in verse 12, we see that there is then this timing. There's a period of time of which the papacy is then allowed to wreak havoc. It then cuts to a new scene in 13, even as we go forward. And I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. So we get these two beings, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and a glory and a kingdom. And all the peoples and nations and languages should serve him. This is telling us about a fifth kingdom, a fifth superpower that will be over and above anything known. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed. Whatever it is, it's going to be set up and it will never fail. That fifth kingdom then, that superpower, is God's coming kingdom. It can only be that. You know, Stephen Covey, if you happen to be one of those readers, I oftentimes reference Covey, and he shows up in many of textbooks that I talk about, specifies to begin, whenever you're finishing a task, begin with the end in mind. You know what God inspires Daniel to do here? Begin with the end in mind. This is the end. Keep this fixed in your eyesight. So what we then find as we come to the end of chapter 14 is we come to this realization that there's this prophecy that's laid out here that's so amazingly accurate and corollary in matching up with Daniel 2 and Revelation 13 and 17. It's like, how in the world is this possible? In fact, many scholars will oftentimes say there's just no way this guy could have written this prophecy in 480 B.C. It's not possible. So many scholars will say the only way this works is if we redate it to 150 AD. But even in this case, they're missing out on God's hand in all of this. Without mistake, what God has done is he's shown Daniel in a dream this timeline of 2,500 years. Which then gets us into the interpretation, which is the second part of this chapter. And I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I saw this stuff, and it had me worried about what I saw. And I came to one of those who stood by in his vision, in his dream, and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts which are four kings. There's our key. That fits with Daniel too. They're kingdoms. They oftentimes are used interchangeably here. They're kings. Kings which arise out of the earth. Kingdoms that arise sequentially out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive. We're right back to verse 14. The saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever. Even forever and ever. He adds elements here with this insert. Verse 19, we continue. Then I wish to know the truth about this fourth beast, because that fourth beast, for whatever reason, is bothering me, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful. With it, teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces and trampled the residue with its feet. And as we make our way through this, even as we've seen what's offered here, we're going to move forward with this notion of horns, because these horns are going to come back up that we've already spoken of here. We know, even as we made sense of it in Revelation, and we've already done this, Revelation 13 and 17 and Daniel 2, that even on that great image, metal, iron is certainly incredibly powerful. And so what we find here is that fourth empire, Rome, is dominating. Verse 20, and about the 10 horns that were on the head and about the other horn which came up before which three fell, namely the horn which had eyes and a mouth which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. And I was watching, and that same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. And so even as we deal with these elements of horns, that little horn arises. Now, you can go back historically. There are a number of different sources you go to. I've mentioned some even in my my references here that help explain what in the world's going on. Even as ancient Rome ended, and we have a sense of ancient Rome ending in 476, there then becomes revivals. And we know these revivals because oftentimes those who happen to have come into a place of power actually called themselves revivals of the empire. And if we go back then, there happened to have been, even after the fall of Rome and that empire, the Roman Empire, there were a succession of leaders that came on the scenes. I'm going to read, paraphrase heavily what's in our UCG commentary on this. I've done a big edit job because I'm not going to have us read long, but I do want to read the one paragraph that fits here. Here is where we could insert a detailed history of revivals, in part by the split in the Roman Empire with Rome in the west and Constantinople in the east, each with an emperor. So in this case, at a given point, that empire actually happened to have divided in two. Whereas Rome fell in 476, Constantinople did not fall for 1,000 years later in 1453. Yet even after Rome fell and was conquered by, we get successions of Roman revival, the Vandals, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths in time, the papacy, oftentimes working behind the scenes in each of those two locations, was oftentimes instrumental in trying to have, say, the military leaders come and take other parts. Sure enough, that's what happened. The papacy, those who happened to be in papal circles in Rome, asked Justinian to come forward and basically take over sections of the empire that had been taken by other countries, by other empires. And the Roman Empire then continued with Justinian, which was considered a fourth revival after those first three revivals, an imperial restoration. It's then traceable, and I won't spend the time because we don't have it here, to go through continual revivals of that Roman Empire, right up to a ninth revival, which we acknowledge as Mussolini and Hitler. Both of which recognized themselves as a revival of the Roman Empire, a ninth revival. In this case, thereby, they are ninth and we wait for a tenth. That's what we're doing now. That may be what we're seeing unfold before our very eyes right now. And so as we see through here, those three horns are replaced by this little horn. That little horn is then, in effect, the leadership of the papacy stepping forward and being vocal. And so we're down to verse 20. I'll read there about the 10 horns that were on the head, and that horn came up, whose mouth, I'm dropping down, spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. If we look at the history of the papacy, they oftentimes sought to do what we're about to see here. They're going to change times and seasons. They're going to change laws. They're going to change holy days. They're going to bring in holidays. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Again, we get a shot forward, a forward-looking statement. Verse 23, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the others, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces, and 10 horns are 10 kings who shall rise from this kingdom, and another shall rise after them and shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue 3 kings. So that timing issue, which is what we've talked through, you already know. And he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. So I shouldn't be admitting this. I got really fascinated the other day. I'm flipping through Peacock Network, and I came across this movie, Conclave. Has anyone seen this movie? Kind of got creeped out all at the same time. I'm like, I got to watch this. And the back of it is all about, the backstory is, and I won't steal this. I'm not going to rip you off, so you can't go see it. It's all about how the decisions are made for the next pope. It's interesting that we have a pope who's kind of tenuous in health right now. But this movie unplugs, unfolds what's happening, what happens when a pope winds up being named, how they go through these processes, how the balloting happens with that. And all, here, I'll give you a cheat, all that happens behind, all the politics that happen behind the scenes, and all the garbage that comes out behind the scenes. Wow, it's kind of ugly to watch. But that said, it's kind of an insight as to, I was actually curious when the movie came out, I was like, is the Catholic Church going to let this go? I'm really surprised they're going to let this play out. But that said, they did. But we get a sense here, again, about what happens behind the scenes, at least with the Catholic Church. It's that papacy, it's that hierarchy of what they believe to them be the Holy Father. And this is part of the reason why I draw on this, because they're oftentimes saying, we're balloting on the Holy Father. And he's just a man. Let's cut to the chase. He's not God. So we're all on the same page there. And he shall speak pompous words against the Most High and shall persecute the saints of the Most High and shall intend to change times and law. And that takes place. We know that. We know the Roman Catholic Church did that. We know with Julius Caesar and the changing of the calendar. We know with the changing of the day of worship. We know this. This is not a surprise of changing holy days and holidays. There's no question there. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. We made reference to that earlier, a span of time before Christ's return. But the court shall be seated, and they shall be taken away, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. Then the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High God. There's this finality that happens on the tail end of his vision. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. So what we're left with is this unbelievable vision of this fifth superpower, this everlasting kingdom coming into being. It ends this way in verse 28. This is the end of the account. And as for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly troubled. I don't get this. What are these beasts? And my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart until a point where he recorded it for us. So what do we take from this chapter? I've got two things I'm asking you to keep in mind even as we end. One is simple, two words, be thankful. Okay, why in the world would he say be thankful? Okay, here we go. Daniel dreamed all of this. He was blessed to understand and write down the interpretation. Shock of shocks, most scholars agree on what I just told you. I have a Bible that sits beside my bed. It's a Zondervan Bible for teens. It's for teenagers, not like they're bad. There is a caption on the right-hand side of chapter 7 that actually lays out sequentially what I just told you in that Bible. Historians, Bible scholars, all recognize, many of them recognize this. Won't say all. I'll be careful and cautious in terms of the statement there. Many of them recognize and are in agreement with what I just explained there. Now, not all the nuances of what are there, but they understand the succession of those kingdoms. So I would offer it's helpful for us at least to understand in light of all of this, because Daniel didn't get it. That even as you and I understand what's there, this should not frighten us. In fact, I would offer the following. An understanding of history should give us peace. Because it's a reminder that God is in charge. That whatever happens in terms of kings rising and kings falling and nations rising and nations falling and empires rising and empires falling, God is still in charge. I'll ask you to go with me to one verse, Isaiah 46:10. This realization that God is in charge of it all, and we've seen this early in the book, all the way through the book, is just a reminder of how great our God is and how thankful we should be in order to understand what's here. Daniel didn't get it. He understood the first empire, he understood Babylon, because he lived through it. And he told Nebuchadnezzar about it. He understood the Medes and the Persians, because he went through that conquering. He didn't live to see whatever other empires there were. And he didn't see what happened after that point going forward. You and I have, you and I understand it, because history has played out before we come on the scene. I'm over in Isaiah 46, verse 10, one verse, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, this being God, saying, my counsel shall stand. I will do my pleasure. Let me paraphrase here. God says, I'm in charge. And I am able to reveal this truth that Daniel didn't get to you. You and I get it. You and I should be deeply appreciative that we get it. It shouldn't be dismissed like we walk out of here and we brush off our sleeves and go, okay, enough out of that. Let's go on. Let's go. What are we getting to eat? What are we doing next? This is powerful knowledge. We should be thankful of knowing this. We've had a unique glimpse into history, and God's informed us of what takes place, which then leads me to a second point or a lesson I ask that we take from this. I'm going to use a funny word that Mr. Garnett actually used in his message several years ago. He said we should be circumspect. I was like, what in the world does that mean? What is circumspect? I actually had to go look the word up. Circumspect means to live our lives considering the consequences of our actions. To live our lives understanding the consequences of our actions. That our actions have consequences, have results. And we have power over that. That's actually a really powerful sense, truth, that we can take from this. Psalm 90. We'll go to one final verse. Psalm 90, verse 12. This should change us. That's where I'm going with this. This should impact our day-to-day lives, knowing as we make decisions that they have consequences, they have results. And when we do so, as we come into situations where, let's say, maybe difficult or we should be wary of, W-A-R-Y, hesitant about, it's telling us something. God has given us a different way to live, so that we have an understanding of his truth and we can be in that fifth kingdom. Psalm 90, verse 12 reads this way. So teach us to number our days. This happens to be from Moses. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Let us live circumspectly. Let us think about the decisions we make. Let's just not go willy-nilly, free-for-all. I'm throwing all the shackles off, everything off. Oh, and then look at my life and go, wow, that's not really working well. Because what God has done is he's entrusted us with a powerful truth that should change who we are. It changed Daniel. And he didn't even understand all that you and I know. So it should change us. Let it change us. Even as we live in Babylon today, he lived in literal Babylon. We live in a Babylonian society. Let us not be swayed, succumb to all the tantalizing things supposedly Babylon gives us. But let us live in honor of what God gives us. Okay, we've been through Daniel 7, two major sections. Well, one dream, two major visions, maybe three scenes, however you deal with this, of which God was inspired Daniel to give. He gave us a timeline of 2,500 years to make sense of. In Daniel 8, the handout shows this, we'll see about a ram and a he-goat. That's next. It's actually going to take a part of Daniel 7, and we're going to expand on it. I would offer the following, even as we conclude. Let us use Daniel 7 not necessarily to understand and just dismiss as I don't get it. Let us use it to move mindfully forward, to be conscious of what we've been given, to understand that God's kingdom is yet ahead. Let us be thankful for what we've been given, and let us live circumspectly as we move toward that time of being part of God's family, when in that time we will live eternally and peacefully with him forever.